The green flag is waving. 25 laps of MotoGP coming up now. Lights out. Good start from Fabio Quartararo. He got that one absolutely nailed. He's flying up the hill. Rossi also with a decent start.
Hello and welcome to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 640. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy, and joining me today, as always, is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, man?
It's good. We had more racing. I like that a lot. And as a guy who roots for chaos, chaos continued. So I'm very, very happy from the weekend.
Chaos did continue. It was actually nuts, and there's some great talking points. But before we get started, we got to do something I haven't been able to do in the last couple weeks, but... Oh, it's beer 30, Jim.
Yeah.
So today, so we have a brewery here. It's called Almanac Beer Company. I think they're up in Oakland, California, if I'm not mistaken. No, Alameda, California. That's right there in the can, Skyler, just so you know.
The but can usually tells you where it's from. That's part of the reason for the labeling of the can.
But I have just fallen in love with this brewery. They have so many good beers that they just keep pumping out, and I've grabbed this new one I saw, and it even had the brand new, so it's really new. It's called Side Hustle Hazy IPA. So let's give this one a sip. Damn, that's good. That is definitely a good beer right there. And it's not as strong as the previous one. It's only 6.1%, so the opinions won't get too bad.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that means it will be 35 minutes into the podcast before Skyler goes off on a rant somewhere.
Most likely. Most likely. Well, Jim, this is a weird show because it's the first time we've ever, and I'm sure this is for anyone that's following racing, that we're going to do back-to-back at the same track. So, yeah. Definitely some different talking points, that's for sure.
But it was so interesting. That's the amazing thing to me is, like, it's the same track, yet it was so different.
Which, it very much was so, especially yeah. in the Moto 2 and Moto 3.
Yes. I mean,
you would expect the guys that were up front last week naturally would be there, and that's not necessarily the case. So
yeah.
There is definitely, when we get down to the racing and the qualifying, some interesting points, and we'll have to definitely discuss why we think that there was such a drastic change in some of these. But before we get there, we did have some listener feedback this week, and that comes from Scott Baldwin. Scott is definitely an old friend of the show here. He put in, Quartararo said he made 6 test starts on Friday and Saturday, and the hole shot device failed every single time. Then the 3 Yamahas got out the front at the start of the race. Do you have a clue of how they did this? Well, no idea, because I don't even know how their hole shot device works. You, Jim, you're the engineer. I'm sure you could take a poke at it.
I don't know how Yamaha's system works, nor do I know how Ducati's system works, but I will say that Rossi and Vinales definitely got a hole shot over top of Quartararo. So Quartararo's still may not have worked. It just so happened he was on the front row, and Quartararo makes pretty decent starts to begin with. So that may be why we had 3 Yamahas out front. I do think that Vinales has been greatly helped by the hole shot device. And I tend to think that it's probably more of an electrical type setting, but I don't know how they would do it with the Magneti Marelli. That's because I don't think it's, I know Supercross, when they do Supercross, they literally push down on the front suspension and it basically has a clamp or a lock mechanism that comes down and grabs hold of the front fork guard and holds it in place until you brake hard enough for it to release. Now, we know Ducati's system must work something similar to that because Jack Miller said last year at Silverstone that he was slamming on the brakes going through the S's at Cops, Maggots, Becketts trying to get the system to release. So I would assume that Yamaha's is sort of the same way, and either the factory team has it adjusted to where it's easy for them to lock it in and then for it to release once they brake hard enough for it, and Quartararo maybe doesn't have it figured out how to actually set it in a proper way, or it's a complicated procedure of do this, and this to get it to actually function the way that we want, and maybe he's just missing it by a little bit. I mean, if it's a mechanical system, I would think that it potentially could be messed up by the fact that you did not apply enough pressure to it, or you didn't hold it long enough for the mechanical clamp to swing back, or something of that nature. But in all honesty, Scott, I really have no idea how they did it. Safe to say that at least it worked pretty darn well on the two factory Yamahas, and Quattraro wasn't too far behind. So I'll keep digging and see what I can find, but I'm not going to make a bunch of promises, because that's really, you know, that's pretty secret stuff.
Right, and obviously they're still working on it, and it does seem strange that we're now getting hole shot devices to help these bikes launch off from the start of a race, when considering, like you said, Supercross has been doing this for years. And so if it was an easy share technology, we would have saw this on road bikes quite some time ago, especially at the top level where every advantage that possibly can be taken will be taken. So I'm with you that this is probably a very complicated system, where they're trying to save weight and do all this fancy stuff and integrate it with previous technology. Who knows? But I'm sure we'll get some interesting articles. I mean, how long was it before, you know, the Ducati hole shot device? I mean, they were spy photos, and then about a month later, it was deep dives on how the system works. So I'm sure we will get something sooner than later on how the system works, and that will probably lead us to some interesting theories on what isn't working or what didn't work at the time.
Well, one thing you got to remember, Skyler, is that we are now in the era of Magneti Marelli. And before that, the factories had unlimited software development. So there was probably hole shot type assistance, but it was built into the software. Because I remember at Laguna Seca one year, Jorge Lorenzo stopped to put the bike into the proper launch mode mechanism, and he didn't get it right. And remember, he high-sided himself to the moon, and what is that turn? Was it 1, 2, 3, 4? Turn 5? Because the bike thought it was somewhere else. It didn't do what they were expecting it to do. And that was because the sequence that he implemented was wrong. So I just think it's a mechanical system, and I think that however it's being held is trickier for Quattraro to understand how to actually make it function. So who knows? We'll find out.
Time will tell. But that's definitely a great question, Scott. Thanks for writing in. Remember, folks, if you want to write in just like Scott did, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. It will go to all of the hosts, so basically Jim and myself. But the former hosts see that well, so you may get a response from Jules. You may get a response from Dave. A rare occasion, you may get a response from Harry Lloyd. You never know, but just go ahead and email us in, and we'll be sure to get that. And if we really think it's a thought-provoking something we want to bring on the show, we will do that as well. All right, so before we get into racing, Jim, I actually did follow through on some homework that I said I was going to do last week. I did create a spreadsheet. I forgot to share it with you because I was doing it before the show. But I do have the list of riders and their age, so we can be a little more educated when we sit there like, oh, is he 30? I don't know. Is he 25? We've got it now. So I'm going to go ahead and pull this up now and kind of just go through it briefly, because that's the kind of thing we do here on MotoPod. All right. So, obviously, I think we all know who the oldest rider in the field is. And that's
Valentino Rossi, 41.
Yes, sir. But who is the youngest?
In MotoGP?
In MotoGP.
It'd be Quattraro, wouldn't it?
Nope.
Ooh.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I said, I did not know that. And
who's younger than Quattraro? Bagnaia?
Nope. He's older.
Really?
This is a tricky one. You gotta. It's a not a fact. I'll give you a clue.
It's not a factory. It's not a factory
team. Mm-mm. Well, actually, it might be. Actually, I think they run four factory bikes. Actually.
So that means it's on a Ducati.
KTM.
Okay. Yeah, because KTM's got four bikes. Oh, Oliveira.
Nope. Iker Lekwona is actually Lekwona. 20 years old. Yes, sir.
Okay. Wow. All right. that shows how bad we actually really are at ages.
And he's 20 as of this year, mind you. Yeah. So, yeah, January 6th is his birthday. So he's definitely the youngest guy in the paddock. Next one up is Quattraro at 21. So he's not much older. But anyway, so we got Dovizioso. He's at 34. Zarco's at 30. Petrucci's at 29. Vinales is 25. Quartararo, like we said, is 21. Morbidelli is 25. Ikarakuona is 20. Andrea Iannone is 30. Taka Nakagami is 28. Brad Binder is 24. Kyle Crutchlow is 34. Joan Mir is 22, another real young guy. Bradley Smith is 29. Alicia Spargo is 30. Alex Rins is 24. Jack Miller is 25. That one threw me for a loop because I forgot just how young Jack was when he came to GP, how he skipped over Moto2. And I'm like, man, Jack's been around forever. I'm like, holy crap, Jack's only 25? Like, yeah. All right.
Wasn't Jack 19 when he went to Moto GP?
I feel that's accurate. He was real young, and there was a lot of skepticism around that move and whether or not it was going to work. I think that move is kind of it's hard to tell. He's on par with the guys that went through Moto2, but at this point, I don't know if Moto2 would have made the difference for him, because he's still really good. Would he have been better if he spent some time in Moto2? Not 100% sure, but then again, someone puts a MotoGP contract in front of you, you sign that dotted line because you don't know if that's ever coming back your way.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Then we got Pol Espargaró. He's at 29. Like we mentioned, Rossi's at 41. Tito Rabat's at 31. Pecco Bagnaia is 23. Alex Marquez, 24. Miguel Oliveira, 25. And Marky Marquez is 27. So, yeah, there's all your ages. The average age is 27. And like I said, the youngest is Lecuona, and oldest is Rossi.
That's interesting. That whole list is very, very intriguing.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously, if you want to be a GP rider, the best bet is to be in your 20s. Because I would, you know, if I really had the time, if I had Harry Lloyd kind of passion, I would bust this out over each decade and see what that average age was over each decade and watch how it tumbles down. Because I'm pretty sure it was much higher when you needed all that experience, especially when guys were wrenching on their own bikes. And look at it now, right? Because back in the day, you weren't putting 20-year-olds on a GP500 bike. It just was not happening.
No. I think you're right about that one. I think if you went back to the 50s and 60s, I think the average age would be probably late 30s, right? And then probably move, as the 70s came, probably would move to like the lower part of the 30s. The 80s would probably bring you into the high 20s, and then now you're bordering on, you know, middle to low 20s would be my guess.
Right. Well, I mean, as soon as if Rossi was to retire, it would throw this whole thing for a loop. Actually, we can do this really quick. Let's just do that. Ooh, and
spreadsheet magic.
Right. Alrighty here, so let's see. Oh, it didn't update. It still says 27. That doesn't seem accurate here. What's going on, spreadsheet? What are we doing here?
Yeah, Excel is difficult because you have to grab all the cells and then say equals average and, you know, all that good stuff, right?
Yep, I'm going to do one more thing. Just here we go. To see. Yep.
He's close. I feel like it's almost there.
Because
it's got to become, what, 20? It's got to go down to about 25.
Oh, we lose a year. It's 26. So if Ross leaves, it's 26. That's
it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, interesting. I found that chart enlightening. It just makes me feel that much older.
And then for some of me, it's like, oh, 36, and watch all these guys are doing like, oh, okay, well. I guess if I was still in GP, I'd be right there with Rossi. I'd be an old dog in the fight. Like, okay, right on.
I'm older than Rossi, so I'd be the very old dog.
Right. You're a team owner at this point, Jim.
Yes, I would be. I would. I'm telling you, if I won the lottery here, I would create a team. I'd go find Casey Stoner. It's like, dude, I will get you a factory bike. Will you ride for me? You won't have to go to any press conferences unless MotoGP makes you go. And let's just go kick some ass. That is like my dream.
I you know, that's one thing that we would, Mark Marquez and Casey Stoner on Hondas and watch them go at it. That would have been something to see. Oh, that would have been something to see.
Yeah. At some point, we got to start talking about this past weekend.
I think that's what we're going to get to. We just had to get a little filler in there. This is not, we don't want to cover the news. That was our news time. It's just that. But we're okay. Actually going to jump into the Moto3 qualifying. I didn't get a chance to catch the Moto3 and Moto2 qualifying. I did catch their races, and I have good detail points on that. But, Jim, you're going to have to definitely take the helm on these.
That's fine. No problem. So, quickly, Coming out of Moto 3 QP1 was Antonelli, it was Sasaki Tatai, Philip Salak, and Ayama Kanada, I think is how you pronounce that one. But it was interesting because nothing was going on, really. I mean, you had Sasaki, Faggia, Bender, and Fanati were all in that first session. And we did get the little bit of thing where Simoncelli was very mad at his riders. He told him that, hey, this isn't good enough. You guys are, it was amateur hour, basically. So we were looking for bigger things to come out of the Sick Corsa team for the race and for the qualifying. So as we went to QP2, after the first runs, it was Agura, it was Fernandez, Rodriguez, McPhee, who looked really good. Now, McPhee had been tipped by Maverick Viñales to look really good in the qualifying and the race. Then Arbolino, Toba, Suzuki, and Tatai. Arenas had some work to do because he was very far down the pack. So this is the guy who's gone 2 for 2, looking for the three-peat. He pretty much looked like he had everything figured out, but he did not have qualifying figured out. Minya went down in that second session, but Suzuki came on and put down a great lap to take pole ahead of Ogura and then Rodriguez. Arenas could do no better than sixth place. McPhee fell from his fourth place, roughly, down to eighth. And I thought that was interesting that McPhee had gone that direction. But right.
Was Suzuki's third pole in a row, right?
Yes. So he had three poles in a row, which was some weird record that wasn't done except for, I forget who they said it was, some Japanese rider back in like 96 or something. He did three races on the trot with poles. So it was a good day for Suzuki. I mean, it was where he wanted to be. The bigger question was going to be, what was he going to do when it came to the race? That's sort of where you're wondering, because he hasn't shown very well during the races. So we were going to have to wait and see how that basically went and plotted along, if we will.
Right, because he's had great qualifying, obviously, three poles in a row, does Skyler. But we had mentioned where he's found a lot of speed, his racecraft just isn't quite there yet. We haven't seen the racecraft. We mentioned that, I think, in the last show, where it's like he's taking a step forward this year for sure. Because overall speed, I mean, look at the lap times, right? Three poles. He's got that bike dialed in. But in Moto3, if you look at the qualifying, the top three or top 13 are covered by a second. That means you won wide in a corner. 10 guys go past you. Now you're in the back. Good luck getting back to the front. So you have to have great racecraft. I mean, if you really want to look back at some of the greatest racecraft in Moto3 recent history, Joan Mir comes to mind right off the bat. That guy was ice cold in the last five laps of a race. Hardly made any mistakes. Because there's a lot of races, I think, he didn't lead more than two laps. It was the first and the last. And that's all you need to do.
Mm-hmm. You could throw Martin in there. Although Martin liked to get out front and just set the pace and make everybody try to catch him. Which was, you know, that's a different style. It's Jorge Lorenzo-esque, but it worked for him. You know, it was always, you know, I think that Martin always had that fight back in him. Like, if he was passed, he made sure that he came right back by you again. That was his thing. He was never going to let you feel like you were safe. You know, hey, this guy's going to come right back by you at the next corner or the next two corners. You're going to have to work for it no matter when you try it. Well, Danny Kent was really good on a Moto3 bike too, right?
He was really good, and he was, I think, the last rider I've seen where he dusted the field from the front. I remember, I think it was 2018 at COTA when they had that mixed weather where the track had dried out for about an hour, I think, before the Moto3 race. So there was a line, and everyone slicks, and he pulled something crazy, like a 16-second gap to second place for the win, which does not happen in Moto3.
True.
If I'm recalling that. If I was Harry Lloyd, I would have had that spit, you know, right on the point. But
you would have, but you're not Harry, so that's okay.
No. I drink beer and get mad. he drinks some Monsters. It comes with facts. It's different lifestyles right there.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so that brings us into our Moto3 race. Now, like we mentioned, Suzuki had three straight poles, and he did great off the line. He got his whole shot. He had an aggressive... He wasn't going to let anybody pass him. I think he set the tone right from the beginning of the race. He gets the whole shot, pulls over towards the right-hand side of the track, going to the first corner, lets everybody know he means business, you're not getting by me, sticks it in there, and they're off. And honestly, for the first 10 laps, good luck keeping track of who is where, because a typical Moto3 race, these guys had to sort it out. It was like water going around rocks. It just flowing through one another. It was pretty insane. And then we started running into some riders going down. Sasaki and Minho, they went down together on lap 8. Unfortunately, Minho got a little ambitious going into the corner. Trail braked a little too long and took out Sasaki. A bit of a racing incident there. Masio and Ogura, they went down together on lap 8. And that was a shame because Aya Ogura has been looking real strong. Masio had made his way back to the front. Actually, this is the crash I'm thinking about. Masio wiped out Ogura. I think Sasaki and Minho had... I think they just had a bump and they came together. Anyway.
Yeah, that was a little more mutual. They were Minho definitely was on the inside. Sasaki left a little bit of room, but that door kind of closed a little quicker than what I think Minho wanted it to be. So they both kind of went down and together in a hump, which happens. It's a racing incident. There was no further action taken to it. Now, the Masi and Ogura one, that was definitely where Masi just was like too late on the brakes. Whoops, too much front brake, trailed it into that first, into the turn, tucked the front, and then, Ogura becomes a victim of what's about to happen. And that's racing too. That's just the way nature of it. You're trying to go in there faster than you've been before. You're trying to stop the bike. You're trying to set it up. And what happens is you wind up having that limit. You exceed the limit of adhesion that's possible, and down you both go. One thing you didn't mention in the beginning was where Binder was. Binder had a terrible qualifying session. I should have said something about that, but it's kind of the normal, right? I think he started 20. I have it somewhere. Second, 26th, 26th. He's 26th. He would, by the third lap, he was already up to 8th. Which is pretty amazing. Amazing. I mean, that was a heck of a ride just to come through that part of the pack. I mean, that's sort of what Binder does. We wait for him to show up on race day and go to the front. But he got there sort of in the beginning. I think if you're in that top 10 lead pack, I think that you have a great chance at winning or being on the podium in any Moto3 race. So for him to get there... And then he sort of stayed with that pack as the race progressed was really telling as we went through. The other thing that I noticed was that down that back straightaway, Arbolino's bike is an absolute rocket ship.
I don't know what they had in that bike or what gearing, but he was a step above everybody on that back straight.
Yep.
No draft either. He would pull around guys that were drafting others. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that was the thing that, and you're right, it was impressive. He's doing it without the draft. It was old school Honda horsepower. And I do not know where they were getting that from in the bike. They're technically they're all the same bike. Everybody gets that bike from Honda. And I don't think that there's a whole lot that they can change. Because I was thinking that they could run their own exhausts from different companies, but I'm not 100% on that one. So they might have gotten a horsepower or two from a different exhaust, but a horsepower or two is not going to make it difference like you saw on that track. So not sure what they got, but it is definitely something to look for, especially when we go to the bigger tracks like Brno and the Red Bull Ring. I think we need to learn to look at Arbolino's bike and watch and see what he can do. I just think it's going to be interesting.
It'll be easy to see. It's a black and purple one, so we'll keep an eye on that one there. But so back into the race here. Now, Suzuki, look, we had mentioned his racecraft had not been fantastic so far this year, but there was an attitude change. I think that talking to he got by Paolo Simoncelli set a fire, because he stayed at the front. Anytime anyone passed him, he got right back around him. He literally was not going to play the let's just see what happens game, right? McPhee was on that game. We'll come to that later. But Suzuki, no matter what, was going to stay his front as much as you can, because like you said, that top 10, if you get into the top 10, you have a chance of winning the race, because that group separates itself and then they start fighting amongst themselves. So you can go from 10th to 5th to 2nd and 3 corners in Moto3. But the main thing is that you don't want to do is be up front and get shuffled to the back, because it's extremely hard, because by that time, all the guys up there with you are pretty much running the same pace. So it's going to be very difficult to get by them. But that brings in, so Suzuki's doing it. And then, unfortunately, not so long after that, Albert Arenas had a huge... Go ahead.
Can we do one more thing about Suzuki here? Because basically we're about halfway through the race, roughly. And Suzuki got a track limits warning. And I thought, oh, this is the end of his race, because he usually is very close to the edge, if not over that edge consistently. And he had the limit, and I thought, oh, I don't want to see this guy get the long lap penalty because he's racing so well. And yet this news is, I think the old Suzuki would have just kept on doing what he was doing and using too much of the track and going out beyond the limit. This new iteration of Suzuki 2.0, if you will, buckled down and did not get a long lap penalty, which it was the key to things. So
yes, absolutely.
I'll let you continue from there. I think that's a critical part of the race.
It very much is, and I'm glad you picked that up, because it is something that during the race I was like, ooh, that's real close to you. And it's so easy in Moto 3 to run wide. These guys take advantage of air lines, huge sweeping lines. And then his bike was having, and not to mention, his bike was not turning so well either. That's probably the reason he was running wide. So he had a fight on his hands through the whole race. Albert Arenas had a huge crash to the gravel. It was kind of strange because he was on the power coming out and they had a front end wash out on him. And the problem was when he went to the gravel, the bike actually, he started to roll over the top of the bike and the bike kicked him up into the air and launched him further, another probably 20 yards or so down the gravel. And he banged him up pretty good. He was walking later on, but you really got to see how hard of a hit, because the slow-mo camera had the best picture, or one of the best pictures I've ever seen, where they grabbed him front and center. You saw the whole thing, and you just see the violence that the gravel trap. Yes, the gravel does slow you down. It is safer, but it is far from pain-free.
Yeah, that was really an interesting crash, because I looked at it as that he had the front end, and I don't know if he actually lost the front and then turned the gas on to try to rotate the bike to help pick the bike back up in that a la Marc Marquez kind of a style, because it was like the front had tucked, or it tucked so violently that the back then broke loose and came around. It was a weird crash in a weird place. It was just before the apex, which makes you kind of think it's going to be the front end, because generally coming in and trail braking to the apex, you're going to eventually over brake and reach the limit of adhesion of the front. But because he had gotten just past the apex and then the back kind of slid around, it made you think that the front end had stuck, and it was like one of those a little too much gas and a little too much lean, and away it went. I'm not sure which way that it was, but I'll go with the front tucked causing the back to come around on him. But that crash was absolutely violent. I mean, they hauled him off on a stretcher, and I was really scared for him, because I thought he maybe, you know, had broken a collarbone, something of that nature. But it goes to show that I don't think he received an injury of any kind, did he, Skyler?
Not that I'm aware of. They did cut to him a little bit later, and he was walking into the medical station. They didn't really have an update at the time, and I might have missed it during the general adventure.
I didn't see anything either. But it's good to see that the safety equipment, the airbags deployed in the suits like they're supposed to, and probably prevented a worse case scenario of him breaking a collarbone, perhaps maybe having sprained his neck or something like that, just because the airbag blows out and prevents that from happening. So the equipment did its job, but it was a scary looking crash, especially for the Moto 3 guys. That was pretty violent.
Yes, it was. It was definitely a race of attrition. We get down to about the last 6 laps here, and old Darren Binder, he's showing up. He's showing out. He's getting his way to the front. You know, this is the thing. We know he's fast. We know he's talented. He has too many trips through the gravel. That's his problem, right? It's the checkers or wreckers kind of thing. And he had a close call. Rodrigo lost his front and directly through the corner right in front of Darren Binder. Darren Binder just had cat-like reflexes, picked the bike up. They nudged tires a little bit and kept going. That was a close one. And then, unfortunately, after that, Dennis Onshu crashed out. It was on his birthday. He looked a little banged up, too. I think he hobbled off under some assistance. And then we get down to the final last couple laps. And this is Moto3 right here. Elbows out. Everyone is flying through the field. And McPhee. Now, you notice, we haven't really mentioned McPhee through this entire race. This guy played the best shadow game I think I've seen in a long time. Now, he's kind of on the opposite end. I think it's Suzuki, where his racecraft is really honed up now. Because I don't think anybody, even the announcers, had mentioned him until the last five laps. And then, poof, he's in podium contention. He's in race-winning contention out of nowhere.
Yeah, I want to call him McPhee the Magician, because he just appeared. He had an eighth place start. He was definitely at the back of the train of 10 for the majority of that race. And as he came through, I think he kind of grabbed hold of Binder and let Binder kind of take him to the front, which is a good strategy, because if you know Binder's coming, and he generally is, and he's generally going to the front, that makes a great strategy. He's kind of pushing everybody out of the way, and you just kind of go with him. But it was weird. You had a six-rider battle that kind of split into a three-rider battle for a couple laps, and then it came back together again for the final three or four, which was really neat to see, because you like those big battles. You like all those people there. And as you said, rightly so, McPhee had come up to being second. Now, the question was, what was McPhee going to do on the last lap? So that's where we're at this point.
Yeah, and so that brings us down to the final couple laps here. It was really tight, but Suzuki, even though they started getting close to him, man, he rode an extremely smart and extremely aggressive race to be right up there. Going into the final corner, you're wondering, is McPhee going to get him on the brakes? McPhee goes down low, he starts to come in, and then I think McPhee started having this instant where he played last week through his head, where he's like, wait a minute, this didn't turn out so well. I'm just going to settle for the points. Tucks it right in behind Suzuki going to final corner. They pull out. Jerez is not really long enough for any draft passes. Suzuki gets across the line, gets the win. McPhee right there behind him, and finishing out was Celestia Vietti. Darren Binder was in with the podium contention, but he made a lunge on the last lap, and he lost a few places after that after running wide. But, Jim, that was an entertaining race for sure.
It was very entertaining. You got to remember that Alcoba actually was running third or running fourth, and he finished fourth on the race. But two laps prior, he was given a track limits penalty, long lap, which he did not take. And then at the end, since he did not take it, the stewards awarded a 3-second penalty, which moved him backwards to seventh place, moving Binder to fourth, which is one of Darren's better results in the Moto3 class. He did exceptionally well. Suzuki is the star of the race. I mean, he was phenomenal every way, shape, or form. I think McPhee played it smart. I think he did have the flashback. Hey, this didn't go real well last time. I missed out on points and got very few. Let me at least take the assured second here and stand on the podium, which was a great play. And he was. Now, did you watch the podium ceremony afterwards?
Oh, the broken bottle.
Yes. So it's Vietti, right? Mm-hmm. And he kind of hops down off of the box of the podium, and he smashes the bottom of the bottle onto the podium, and it just shatters into glass. And he cut his hand pretty bad, because if you watch, you can tell, you know, it shattered, and then you kind of see, if you look, you can see his hand kind of turns red there on the podium. He eventually, I think he got a couple of stitches out of that one.
Mm. So yeah, he was trying to get there where you bang the bottle and get it fizzing up really fast, uh-huh. And he just got a little too aggressive with that. That's actually a pretty good hit to break a champagne Ooh. Bottle. Those things are thick on the bottom.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it actually cracked at the top. It wasn't really the bottom that cracked. It's like it shattered up on the neck area where he was actually holding it. Because he kind of lets go of it, and there's all these glass pieces, and you're just going, what did you just do, buddy? And I guess, you know, like they say, you have to be young and stupid to become old and wise, and I think he's not going to do that one again. But it was great to see him on the podium, because I think that was his first podium, maybe, in the class. So that was really good. But, you know, cutting your hand, not so good. But, you know, again, chaos. I root for it, and that was more chaos.
So we'll do our top 10 here for the race. It was Suzuki in first, McPhee in second. Viette, it was third, running at the podium. Darren Binder, we mentioned, was fourth. Gabriel Rodrigo, there's a name that's been in Moto3 for quite some time, was finishing fifth. Raul Fernandez in sixth. Jeremy Alcoba, like we mentioned, he had the penalty. He's finishing there in seventh. Sergio Garcia in eighth. This is a name I'm going to have to learn. It's Ryusei Yamanaka, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right. Ask your wife. She should know.
If it's for real, right? She's going to make a face mask up and ask her, too. You know, it's hilarious because we moved not too far from the last house, but the moment we get here, our neighbors are Japanese, too. And I'm just like, ha, 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 ha. And they're, like, from Japan. So it's like, oh, yeah, you can speak the language. She just looks at me like, whatever. And right out of the top 10 was Tony Arvelino. So definitely a bit of a mix there. Names that we're expected to see at the front. But there's one name that has seemed to have fallen off this year, and Romano Fanati, nowhere in that race. I mean, he finished 12th, but that was definitely with a lot of guys in front of him falling off of bikes, and just at no point was he even on the TV screen. What's going on there?
I don't know. Since it's Stel Grotta, he's past his sell-by date. Sorry, I couldn't resist the pun. But, I mean, I don't know what's up with Fanati. I don't know if he just hasn't gelled with that KTM to finding Husqvarna, so that he gets the good setting that he needs. He just seems to be off. And I don't know if it... I mean, it's 2 years removed now since we've had the infamous incident at Misano. And as a racer, you got to kind of push that back out of your mind. I don't think he wants to be the bad boy of Moto3. But if he doesn't become the bad boy of Moto3, I don't think he's going to be at the front. It's interesting that he hasn't gone anywhere with it. You know, I don't think Biaggi runs that team just because he can. I think he wants that team to be at the front and have results. And he had great races and great results with Canet, who has moved on to Moto2, as he should. He's a great rider. But given all the other talent that's actually in the class, you'd think Biaggi would have taken somebody else other than Fanati. Now, Fanati, of course, is Italian, and Stel Grotta is an Italian, you know, milk producer. So, sure, it kind of fits, but I don't think that that's really necessary for Biaggi to actually have and run a team, depending on what, you know, who's on the bike for what sponsorship.
I can tell you exactly what happened here, or at least I can tell you what I think happened. The reason why he couldn't get any other Italian riders to ride for his team is because they all belong to the VR46 Academy.
Fanati got booted out of there again. Well, this is going to be really interesting. So let's assume that Rossi retires. Rossi has his own. He actually has a good part of Petronas Sprinter Racing, right? And then at some point, he's going to have Sorakis Rossi, a Moto3 team, a Moto2 team, and a MotoGP team. At some point, Biaggi and Rossi will get together behind the trailers, and Biaggi will show back up with a bloody lip and claim that a mosquito bit him.
Oh, man. What are we, circa 2003 with that one there?
Hey, I'm old enough to remember it. I'm going to use it.
For those of you that don't know what we're talking about, you need to go watch Faster, and that'll fill you in on the details.
Oh, yes, it will.
Alrighty. So that brings us down to a championship. Now, Albert Reynes, because he won the first two races, he's still in the lead, but only by 6 points. He's got the 50, but Suzuki had a nice points grab this weekend, bringing himself up to second in the championship with 44 points. John McPhee, there's a reason why he settled for those points, because he's now in third on 40 points. Aya Ogura, after the crash, still within the championship hunt, but he's sitting back on 36. And Gabriel Rodrigo rounding out the top five at 30 points, just 20 points back. In a shortened season, you do not want to lose ground. So definitely, Arenas, he had an opportunity to keep his lead wide open, but this is what happens. This is why Moto3, it's important to score as many points as you can, because you never know how it's going to go. And that brings us down to Moto2 qualifying. And I see what your talking point here for the first one is Jim. And Yep. I agree.
It's like instant replay. Joe Roberts is in Q1 again. The kid does not have the magic that he had in Qatar. Now, a lot of people were saying that, hey, this is a track he just doesn't get along with. And, you know, that some riders don't gel with some racetracks. He does gel with Brno. There's a week off in between now, us leaving Spain, going to Slovakia, and going to Brno. Hopefully, he takes that week. He thinks about what's going on. He comes back a little bit stronger. But it was disheartening to see him down there again in the Q1 session. He was there with Cyrene and Bastianini and Della Porta and Schrader. But Bastianini went through, Vietti went through, Simone Corse and Schrader. They all went on to the Q2. So in QP2, got to give a shout out to Edgar Pons. He was like third or fourth in a couple of sessions, a couple of practice sessions. He was into the Q2 without having to come through Q1. He was looking good for Edgar Pons. So shout out to him for that. Nagashima had a bad high side in practice. He went over the top, smacked his head. I mean, just dead on flat smack right onto the asphalt. It was nasty looking. They said he was okay. They said he had a headache. I think he was concussed, but I'm not a doctor. But yeah, I don't think you can take that kind of hit and not have some problem inside your brain for at least a little bit of time.
This is a good point to bring up, because I wondered, because when we get to it in the race, he wasn't himself.
Correct.
And I did not know this was going on. And after the race, he looked completely spent. But definitely, and we've come to know concussions quite well in this country because of the NFL. I think we're all a little bit more open in understanding of how this works. And a concussion doesn't mean you have to get knocked out. A concussion is just a bruising of the brain, which can happen anytime, like when you see stars, that's considered a concussion. So there are many forms and degree of concussion that you can get. And yeah, like you said, you go up to the moon and come back down and smack your head, that is most likely going to be a concussion. You have a headache, I can guarantee it's a concussion now.
Well, they said he did have one, so I guarantee you he was concussed.
Yep, for sure. Alrighty.
So as we continue through second qualifying, Martin, who had been fast all practice the whole time, suddenly now has a front end problems. Hugh was a great shot. He comes into the pits. He sits down in the chair, and what is it? It's two hands over top of each other, like the front end had just folded up on him, and that's exactly what happened. He wound up finishing seventh on there, but Bezzecchi would get the pole position. Sam Lowes would be second, which is a great result for Sam. And then joining them on the front row was Bastianini. Navarro, again, on the first two rows with the speed up. This is where we expect Navarro to be. Things are looking up there. Luca Marini was in at fifth. Martin actually was sixth. I forgot. I think I said seventh. I was wrong. And then Aaron Canet looking good again as well on his Moto 2 rookie season. Then Boliga, Luthi, Schrader mounted out your top 10. So it was setting up pretty good for the race. And as it started out, we had Lowe's sort of going backwards, and Marini kind of went forwards to get the third. And it was Bezzecchi, Bastianini, Marini, Navarro, and that was, and Canet, Lowe's, and Martin. Jake Dixon went down. He tucked the front. Again, there's another one of those things where, hey, it's racing. Bastianini was slowly starting to pull away. I mean, he was a few tenths faster than anybody else on the track, and he was starting to inch away from Marini. He was starting to get a little gap on Bezzecchi, and he was basically just putting in the good laps that was there. We then got to the Navarro had to actually give back a place. So there was an incident where...
Oh, this was so good.
Yes. So there was an incident where Navarro actually passed Martin going into turn six, and there was waving yellow flags because of it. So Navarro was ordered to, hey, you need to give a place the place back. The problem was there was a whole pack of guys behind Martin. So Wiley Navarro goes wide at the last turn and then just cuts back and dives right back into this little tiny gap between where he needed to be one place behind Martin and not let anybody else back in front of him. It was extremely well executed. It didn't really help matters that much because Navarro would go on to crash in turn nine. How many guys went down in turn nine this weekend? That was like the place where everybody was like losing the front.
Those corner marshals were very busy this weekend. Oh,
I felt sorry for them having to run out in the heat, pick up these hot bikes and whatnot. It was
Speaking of heat, yes. Man, it was extremely hot. I saw an infographic during one of the sessions where there was like one part of the track, the track temp was 145 degrees. I'm like, are we in Jerez or are we in Qatar? Where are we at right now?
Yeah, it was. I remember that the start of the MotoGP race, it was 96 degrees. That's stifling. So, we had Navarro had then crashed. And after, you know, making the really nice move to get back in line, give up only one place, it was good. Then you had Marini, who was just stalking Bastianini. It was like Bastianini had this bit of a lead. Marini was right there, and he was just keeping pace, keeping him honest. He wasn't getting that far away, but it was definitely where Bastianini was in control, but he had to be sure he was still hitting his marks, hitting his brakes right, doing everything that was supposed to do when he was supposed to do it, because he could feel the hot breath of Marini behind him. Now, Nakashima was trying to figure out where his pace was in the race.
He was trying to figure out where he was in the race.
It might have been just that, but I think from the first few races, we sort of think that Nakashima is going to start slowly. He kind of gets 5-8 laps, maybe 10 laps into these races, and suddenly he finds that he's on pace. He's running as fast, or if not a little bit faster than the guys who are in front of him, and he kind of starts to march his way up through the field. But if you watched how he was riding, it was like he didn't jive with the motorcycle. He was sloppy. You know, there's a point when you're going into the turn where everything is a very crisp motion. It's okay. I roll off the gas. I grab the front brakes. I start to pull in. I'm back shifting. There's a very distinct flow. It all happens in a very natural way. You're in a rhythm, a groove. These things happen, and it's all essentially controlled chaos, for lack of a better description. If you saw Nakashima go in the corners, it was like, okay, I'm going to let off the gas. Oh, I need to brake. Oh, I need to start back shifting. Okay, that's what I got to do next. You could see where there was thought taking process, which is why I go with he might have been concussed from the crash that he had, because it's not that quick, rapid fire things all happening on all cylinders. It was like somebody took one or two spark plugs out of the motor and it just was not clicking for him.
No, it really wasn't. He never looked himself this whole weekend, and to even finish where he finished was pretty good, but he had a lot of people fall out. But definitely a weekend that he's probably going to want to forget, and I hope he can get back to the front because he's fun to watch, and we just want more competition at the front. This week, when I was watching the race, and like the first three, like you mentioned, as it kind of went there, they started to get spread out, and the race kind of went away from itself there for a little bit.
Yeah, up to this point, the race is actually pretty good. It's pretty close. You're not too sure. You get it figured out probably who's on the podium, but you're kind of thinking they could change, they could swap places pretty easily, but you know, Hafisaurin crashes, Bastianini does not fold under the pressure of Marini. In fact, he starts to pull away, and with about four laps to go, Bastianini was gone. Nobody was going to touch him. The race was over there. The only thing that happens at the end is Lowe's was starting to be gapped by Bezzecchi. So Lowe's, who was starting to make a run at things and trying to go to the front, winds up, you know, stopping and his progress being limited as Bezzecchi kind of ups his pace a little bit with Marini as they tried to up their pace to kind of go with Bastianini. So the front three guys kind of tend to disappear a little bit. They had about a half a second on Lowe's, or at least Bezzecchi did at the flag. He had about a half a second on him. We had Baldassarre crash with two laps to go.
What's going on there?
I don't know.
We came in thinking this is a championship contender. He looks lost. Now, I remember he had a big change, I think, when they changed the tire. Not the compound, but the shape
they
of
changed
the tire.
They went to the bigger profile tire. Because he won the first like three races, or did really well in like the first three races. We got to Jerez. Dunlap brought the new bigger rear slick that was supposed to – a bigger profile slick that was supposed to help with the Triumph motors and the torque and all that. And he has never figured it out from there.
No. And he looks like he's just taken another step back this year. It's really weird to see. We know he's fast. We know he can run at the front. And
won races at the front.
Yeah. And even lead the championship. I mean, we're talking – he really is a championship contender. And – he just looks stuck in the mud lately. I think his confidence might be a little washed out, and maybe you hate to say it, but maybe because they've been, I would assume they've been throwing everything at the bike and making every change, and he can't go any faster. He may be starting to lose confidence in his team, and when all those things start to come together, it just makes for a big old huge mess, and then he goes out there and crashes, and man, they really need a good weekend real soon.
Yeah, real quick. Real quick or else this season is just done for. But that's the race. Bastianini wins it. Marini, Bezzecchi, Lowe's, Canet. Martin struggles to a sixth place finish. Luthi looked much better than he did the first weekend. We're running seventh. Verhey, the Enigma, is eighth. Then you had Manzi ninth. Schroeder was 10th. So there's your, and then Nagashima winds up on 11th. Now, he did have a soft front tire where most people had gone with the medium tire. So he was struggling a little bit with the tire, but he was not himself at all. But the real interesting fun part of the race was after the flag, where teammates Marini and Bezzecchi tried to congratulate each other and they take each other down. The slow-mo photos of that on Instagram are hilarious. I mean, it's just like, did you guys really just crash into each other trying to high-five each other after the race?
Right, on a cool-down lap at about 40 miles an hour or less, and then knee hits bar, got one hand off the bar, down you go, skittle. Yeah, then you got to go to the podium. So on one hand, you're celebrating, and then you got to look across and see the boss man there, and he's got to be like, "I'm glad you won, but guys, really?"
It was. Something. I can't remember whose bike was running or got running first, but I think it might have been. I thought Marini might have been pushing Bezzecchi's bike so they could bump start to get it going to get it back. It was hilarious. I mean, it falls in that category of shit happens, but it was still funny. I'm sorry. That is going to be meme material for now, for the next, till the end of the year, until somebody else does something really stupid, you know. So,
right. Cue the Benny Hill music. There was interesting. I don't know if we mentioned, but you know, Navarro, as he was having a good race, he washed out, and that's two races in a row, isn't it, for him that he's crashed out now for Navarro? And I mean, his season is essentially, his championship hopes are pretty much abolished at this point. And that's not good, because he was another guy that we thought was going to be running up there, especially with the way he finished last season on that speed up. You're thinking to yourself, like, okay, speed up has figured something out. They're coming this year and we're going to have something good. And it just hasn't quite worked out in the way that we thought it would for them. But, you know, we had a lot of followers, you know, in this race, and it was kind of predictive that the track conditions were very tricky. It was hot. It was greasy. We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 riders go down in Moto2. And this is something that, you know, the MotoGP riders surely were looking at going into their race. But we'll get to that in just a second. But let's go over the championship. How are we looking there, Jim?
So Nagashima still leads on 50 points. He's only 2 points ahead of Bastianini, then Marini, Canet, Baldassare, Jorge Martin, Sam Lowes, Remy Gardner, Chave Verhe, and then Marco Bezzecchi on 20 points. So as far as the smaller categories, the championship really hotted up here because you got 6 points in Moto3 between the top two, and you have only 2 points between the top two in Moto2. So these championships are going to be pretty awesome, especially considering we're not too sure if we're going to get any more rounds added to it. You know, Formula One announced that they were going to added 3 rounds to this to their season. MotoGP hasn't added anything, but there's the hope that maybe they do add something. There's a rumor going around that MotoGP may go to Portimao and run a race there. That'd be sweet. I'd love to see bikes there, but that's still in the to be determined category. So, go ahead.
Honestly, I think they have they got to play a little bit longer wait and see game. They don't have the might of like F1 where they can F1 controls the tracks, right? They go out, they set their schedule, and everybody else follows suit. That's probably something they're looking at as well. Plus, they also want to see how this coronavirus works out for GP. I think GP is very cautious with how they spend their money, and. You know, we're starting to see, we've had a couple cases of coronavirus pop up in F1. Luckily, it was isolated incidents of basically team members that didn't even travel to one of the tracks, so they were able to kind of nip that in the bud. But this is very realistic that if one of these team members gets it, it spreads really quickly, it can shut the season down. So you don't want to make too many commitments until you have to. And I think a lot of tracks are understanding that they've got a few lined up, but they're not going to sign anything for, I mean, I think they're going to wait until they're at least another 3 races in before they make any announcements of adding any more tracks to this year.
I know Formula One added races because of their commitment to TV and 15 rounds being televised. So they kind of had to contractually. I don't think MotoGP has that, and I think 13 is enough. And I think we should just, you know, let's just see how it goes. But I would like to err to the side of caution. Be sure everybody's safe and healthy. And hey, we had a good season. Let's move on.
Anyone leading the championship is agreeing with you right now, too.
Right. Nobody who's not is not agreeing with me. Yeah, that's how it rolls.
So it's all right. So that brings us into MotoGP qualifying. So in Q1, we all sat anticipated. Now, Mark Marquez, Jim called it. Jim said it last week. He said 7 days, Mark is going to be back on the bike. And all of us are like, ha-ha, no way. He was back, ladies and gentlemen. He had surgery. Dr. Mir put a pin in his arm, and he decided, I'm going to go.
Did you see Marquez's Instagram? If you haven't seen it, go find yeah. Mark Marquez's Instagram. He has pictures of his arm, how bad it was broke, and then the 15 screws in the plate that's holding it all back together again.
It's nasty.
This kid walks into the paddock. You know, basically that was on Tuesday. So he had surgery on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. He walks in 4 days later. He tries to race a motorcycle. There's a video out there of him doing 50 push-ups, no problem.
Yep.
Now, I mean, the kid's almost superhuman.
Yeah, and this is where I actually wanted to take a moment and talk about something here and get your opinion on it. In any boxing or UFC mixed martial arts, your corner protects you. If they see you're losing the fight to the point where you're getting hurt, a fighter's instinct is to not ever give up. And so they throw in the towel. MotoGP and motorcycle racing in general has a bit of an image problem with this, especially in the age where, you know, doctors looking the other way. I mean, we saw this in the NFL and it has come to a really gruesome realization of guys have been working through these injuries they shouldn't have and have really long-lasting effects on their health and their well-being. And motorcycle racing, yes, I understand you have to be tough to do this, but, you know, you're getting 15 screws put in your arm for a bone you just broke, and you're going to come back and try to ride a 220 horsepower machine that has a weight to horsepower ratio of about a pound and a half, and you're going to go out to the best in the world. And you just got to think that's putting yourself in a dangerous position to get even more so hurt and put those around you in danger. When is someone just going to say, no, sit down and heal up? It just seems that we've gotten a little too comfortable with allowing every injury to say, hey, that's okay, just come back and ride. Because as we saw with Cal Crutchlow and Alex Rins, even though they got to ride, I mean, is it really worth it?
That's an interesting take. I mean, Matt Oxley had in his race review article talking about the, hey, guys have always done this. It's just now the technology of the surgery makes it more easily doable, if you will. Look at Jorge Lorenzo. He crashed at a wet Assen. He flew to Barcelona, had surgery on a collarbone. Okay, collarbone, completely different than breaking your humerus into two pieces. But he had it plated, he had it screwed, and finished fifth, I think, at Assen on that Saturday. Okay.
Also, he also had the broken ankles in China in, what, 2008? And bike stalled on the line, and Push started himself on that bike and got going. And I think he finished fifth in that race?
Yeah, he finished pretty far up, as it was. I don't know where to be in this one. Because Marquez himself decided that he, you know, could not do what he needed to do on the motorcycle and said, no, I'm not racing. Okay. There have been other people who, you know, Cal was very much walking wounded. He rode. Rins is very much walking wounded, and he rode. Now, I think it's got to be up to the rider whether he wants to try or not. But there probably needs to be a little stricter medical requirement for you to have the ability to get back on that bike. I don't know all of what they made Marquez go through. I know that he had to do 50 push-ups, and he knocked that out of the park. You know, I remember Colin Edwards having a collarbone that was broken and plated, and they made him do a bunch of push-ups. In Matt Oxley's article, Cal Crutchlow said that when he had broken his ankle, they made him run across the Clinica Mobile room like four or five times, and he said that was incredibly painful. I think I don't have anything against Dr. Costa. I mean, he saved McDuin's leg.
Is he even there anymore? I thought they.
No, he's not. He's not. But what I was getting at is, Dr. Costa did not tell these guys no. He was okay. Let me help you. So it was, you know, pain medicines or whatever it was that allowed you to actually ride. Costa would do. Now he's not there anymore. But I think all of these guys have watched that happen over time, and they're not going to not want to ride or try to ride. Again, there's a perception of you're weak if you don't ride. You're not the warrior that we thought you were. You're not the athlete we thought that you were. And I think that's a bunch of hooey, right? Does anybody think less? Would anybody think less of Cal Crutchlow if Cal Crutchlow said, I can't ride because my scaphoid bone hurts? Would anybody think anything less of Alex Rins if he says, hey, look at the x-ray of my shoulder. My tendons are all screwed up in here. My shoulder's dislocated. I can't race. I'm not going to. I don't think, you know, team managers would, because these guys are pushing the limit all the time on a bike, and these injuries will happen. I think that there's just something ingrained inside of them that says, well, I got to try. I'm going to go do this anyway. Because I'm a he-man, which is kind of in almost every sport. But you know, back to the question, I think MotoGP has to set a different kind of a standard. And I think it might be, I don't want to say this is the way to do it, but as an example, hey, you crashed in the race the prior week, you broke a bone, you went and got it plated, and we're racing next weekend. There needs to be 7 days or 10 days from the date of your surgery to the time that you're allowed back on a bike, attempt to ride. I think they need to do something of that. You know, here in the States with I Love Hockey, they have a concussion protocol. You know, if they think that you have a concussion, if you're starting to look a little weird, you know, and you're skating, you've got to go to a quiet room. You have to be evaluated. And until you can go back and you take another, you know, EKG test, I think that's the right one they use is EKG. I'm not, you know, that's your heart. There's some brain monitoring test where they can see how your brain's functioning. And if they've got a standardized test and they know what you scored on it, and until you can score on that again and you're headache free for X number of days, you don't get to play hockey. Do they need something like this in MotoGP? Maybe. But I'm not the one to make that call.
No. It's just, it is interesting. I think maybe it's something they will look like. My concern is just the protection of the rider from themselves. I mean, just like the fighter, these guys are going to want to compete no matter what. And someone needs to be the small voice in their head saying, hey, relax. Like, look, Marquez, can you just give us 3 races off so the championship can be a little interesting at the end of the year? Because we know you're going to come back and win probably half, if not more, of these races that are left. We just want to make it interesting. We don't want to blow out, all right? Just chill. Just chill, dude. That's the thing, though. That guy's gotten to where he is because he has no chill. So, what are you going to do? But anyway, back to Q1. We did have the walkie wooded through Q1 with Marquez, Rins, Crutchlow, Dovi in this. Alex Marquez went down and looked like he hurt his right arm real well, but he did make it back for the race, so that was good. Dovizioso did not make it out of Q1. And
what's going on there?
Yeah,
like, Dovizioso.
Yeah,
The whole factory Ducati team looks like crap compared to Pramac.
They're getting spanked by Pramac. Pramac looks like it's not even close right now. Mm-hmm. And they should have. Now, Miller, I will say he should be up there. But Bagnaia, right there with him. In fact, when we get to the race, it was heartbreaking. But, dude, what, like you said, the entire operation over at Ducati right now, they look lost.
They do.
And if they're sitting there thinking like, oh, yeah, well, if Dovizioso doesn't want to come back, well, shit, just bring up Bagnaia at this point.
I agree.
Why even bother with it? If he doesn't want to race and he wants to take the money, you've got a guy in the wheat right now after a whole 2 races at the same track. We're getting way ahead of ourselves on the year. But Dovizioso, after hurting himself, and now he's lost all leverage in his contract talks, and now this performances. And let's be real, the reason he's finished as high as he has is because guys in front of him have done and fall off the track. So, yeah, little loss, but then again, they've never been great at this track, and we're gonna get to some tracks for Dovizioso as well. So, like we said last week when we talked to Rossi, we may not, but we'll get to that. Here was something interesting. Repsol Honda, after qualifying in Q1, was going to be started dead last and second to dead last. Now, speaking of teams that shouldn't be there, now of course Marc Marquez hurt. We have to understand that if he wasn't hurt, probably dead last and first. Alex, you know, if people wondered why they bumped him out and moved Pol in. Look, Pol's been in GP for years. He's proven he can ride mini bikes. He's proven he can ride at the front. He's fast. We don't know anything about Alex. He looks like a rookie, and he looks like a rookie that's way out of place on a bike that is extremely difficult to ride. We know that Honda's not easy to ride. Everyone says it. And this is probably the worst bike to get into GP on, to be honest.
I would agree with you. As a rookie, it's probably the wrong bike. But there was a rookie named Marc Marquez who hopped on that bike and won a championship. So,
well, he hopped on Danny Pedrosa's bike and won a championship. So,
that's very true. That's a very true statement in that regard. But let's kind of bring qualifying home here. It was a fight for pole between Vinales and Quartararo. Quartararo was on pole. Vinales had a lap that was going to be faster than Quartararo and be on pole, except for he ran afoul of track limits. Got it knocked off. He didn't get it. Shout out to Nakagami. He had top 2 sessions that day, and he started eighth. And then, but he had did crash in the last turn with a hot lap going that would have probably put him maybe on the second row as opposed to starting on that third row. So, and then Marquez, you know, went out. He did one lap. He came back in. The reason being was that his forearm, his elbow swelled up. That swelling caused pressure on the nerve that runs down along the bone. He couldn't feel what was going on. So since he couldn't feel, he had told his team that happened in the Q4 or free practice 4 session. He says, I'm going to go out and try to go around and qualify. If I have the same problem, I'm pulling it in, and that's it, the weekend over. And that was it. Weekend was over. Before we go to the race, one last thing. It was, you said this, Skyler, and I'll give you credit for it. It was a great call. There was a lot of talk about saying that, at least from KTM, that 30% of what happens on race day is because of what you do on Saturday qualifying. They made a big deal about the KTMs having to qualify better than the Ducatis because they needed to be in front of them. And Binder and Espargaro looked good, but I have to admit that definitely Binder looked better than Espargaro did at the time. And, you know, Binder qualified 9th. Espargaro was 12th, just to kind of throw those out there. And, you know, and Oliveira was actually 5th on a KTM. So,
yeah, there was a surprise.
Whoa, where did that all come from? But, more, yeah. Again, this is the chaos that Jim loves. You know, I've rooted for chaos, and here's chaos. You have KTMs and you know, and Bagnaia's on in 3rd qualifying. I mean, it's all upside down and twisted, and it's so cool that it's that way. It just makes this, you know, so interesting that all of this is going on. So there we are.
Absolutely. And don't forget Valentino Rossi finishing there in 4th in qualifying. Correct. Dragging himself out of the depths of last weekend where he looked like everyone was saying, oh, he's done. And no, maybe not.
You
maybe
discount
not.
Rossi at your own peril.
That's right.
If you think Rossi's done, that's just when Rossi digs that much deeper and comes out fighting. I mean, well, what do they say? Like a wounded animal is its most dangerous because it's wounded. I mean, that's kind of where Rossi is.
Yep. I would agree. That takes us in the race. So we have here, we got 3 Yamahas up front. Now, that, like we said, the Yamahas have been notorious to start. We alluded to this in the beginning when we were talking about the hole shot device during the email with Scott. And the Yamahas did get off the line well. Quartararo, like I said, he got off a little bit worse, but it's okay. He was already in front. Takes into the first corner in front of Vinales and in front of Rossi. And it was a Yamaha 1-2-3. All the great starts. And I think that was the last time anyone was really near Quartararo, but unfortunately, after such a great qualifying, Miguel Oliveira goes down in the first corner, and he looked kind of be hurt, and unfortunately, he came together with Binder, who got tied up with Smith, and they end up running, bumping each other, and taking out Oliveira. Oh, I mean, we had so much promise to the KTMs in this race, and all that was erased in one corner right off the bat.
Yeah, really felt sorry for Oliveira. I mean, he sort of did a little high side, had that big flip up there, and he came down square on his hip. And that, again, if you thought Nagashima's crash in Moto 2 was nasty with him hitting his head, this was equally as nasty, and it was kind of going along with the theme of everybody crashing.
Yeah,
so chaos ensued, which is what we're here for.
It took him a minute to get himself together. It looked like maybe his brain's a little rattled, he's out of breath, but he sat there for a minute in the gravel before he kind of wandered off there. And then, you know, I have here in my notes, it's so funny that I'm like, oh, like Primark Ducati is looking better than the factory squad. That's in my notes, because at this point, the red and white bikes were way, way ahead of the factory bikes, and they were looking strong. In fact, they were looking like they could, outside of Quartararo, they looked like they were going to snatch up all the podium places there up where they were running. Rossi was, at this point, he was up there in second, but he was holding up Vinales, which was allowing Quartararo to escape, and Quartararo was out there doing it the Jorge Lorenzo way, just knocking lap after lap after lap, only a tenth here, a tenth there in difference, and pulling away. Once Vinales did finally get around Rossi, he was able to pull it, but it did take some time. Iker Lecuona, he low-sided in the final corner with 19 to go, and then here we go, we start. Aleix Espargaró, he crashed out, and then at this point, Quartararo was long gone. The Primark Ducati would even start to get after Maverick Vinales. And then Maverick Yelz got beat up there for a little bit for a few laps. He actually went all the way back from third to sixth. And then Miller crashed out with the front end. And then Petrucci goes down. And at this point, they're all dropping like flies. Brad Binder went down with 12 to go.
That was a nasty high side.
Oh, it sure was. Morbidelli goes out with a technical issue. His engine just seemed to stop on the straightaway there.
Oh, I felt heartbroken for Morbidelli because at that time, Morbidelli was the fastest guy on the track.
He was.
I mean, he wasn't going to catch Quartararo. But Morbidelli was looking at like a podium for sure. I mean, that was like a third place guaranteed kind of a thing.
It was. He was looking smooth, and as the fuel was burning off, the bike was coming to him. Crusher pulled in. He had a little break. I think he pointed to the bike, but I really think he just needed a break to give his wrist just a lap there, just about.
Yeah, and yeah. What happened to him was he got – it's the same kind of thing. Everything started to go numb, and he didn't have any feeling. And he ran wide off the track, came back on, went into the pits, and then he was able to stop for a minute, kind of get the blood flow working and moving again. The numbness went away. And that's when he hopped back on the bike and went out and finished. Mm-hmm.
And then here comes the worst, most heartbreaking part. Just like Quartararo had last year when he was running in such a strong position, Pecco Bagnaia, running in second, got a gap. You know, he's not catching Quartararo, but he's got a gap behind him. He's looking good. And then the bike starts puffing smoke. And then it full on just starts billowing smoke out of the tailpipes. And he sees the meatball flag. He's got to pull over. Race done. Horrible, horrible luck. He was doing so well, Jim.
Yeah, that gutted me right there. It was the kid was racing immaculately on a bike that we know isn't the best around Jerez, and he just looked brilliant on it. You know, he just was smooth, controlled. I think that was going to wind up being a third place without any problem. Whether he got the second. I don't think he would have gotten Vinales, but Rossi, he definitely had Rossi handled. And then just to have that happen to him was just gutting. I felt as bad for him as I felt for Morbidelli. That's the one thing as a rider, when something like that happens to the bike, you're just so deflated because you know there's nothing you could do about it. It wasn't like, oh, if I would have rode this way, it would have lasted or it wouldn't have. No, that has nothing to do with it. You were doing everything that you needed to do, and you were doing it right, and your bike let you down. And that's the one thing that you have to remember is that you did nothing wrong. You were doing everything to the best of your ability. You were on par for or on track for the best finish you ever had or a win or a victory, whatever it is, and then you got let down by your bike. So you can't let yourself get down on it. You got to look at the positives of what you were doing, and then you got to look at it, and you got to look at the guys who tune your bikes and take care of them, and you got to say, hey, guys, that's racing. That's why we race. We're just going to come back at it next weekend, right? Okay? Because the worst part is that you're heartbroken, and you are way down on yourself. You're down on everything about it, but you need to understand it, and the good ones do. These guys do. They know that the guys that are working on those bikes pour their heart into it, and they feel probably twice as bad as what you are. But you got to walk in there and you got to pick those guys back up because those guys are just going to work that much harder for you. And that's. I hope Bagnaia did. I hope he walked right back in and said, "Hey guys, it's racing, man. We're going to come back at Brno and do just as what we've been doing here before, and we're just going to keep going." And yeah, so that was chaos. I mean, again, there's chaos everywhere, right?
There was.
And it's just crazy.
This brings us down. You know, Rossi proves he's still a demon of the brake. Maverick Viales needs to go to braking school. I mean, it wasn't like close braking. He was getting just worked by Valentino.
It isn't his
style. Yeah.
He's a Jorge Lorenzo riding kind of guy. It's very easy on the brake, the flowy, sweepy line. Nothing's late about it. You know, if you ever watched Jorge in his prime, he braked earlier than anybody. It's just he let off the brakes earlier than anybody and carried way more corner speed. And sort of Vinales is kind of in the same boat. You know, it's hard to. That's the magic of Quartararo. Like, he understands that sometimes it's okay to ride that bike on a big sweeping arc line, but due to other people around you or due to maybe what's happening on the rear tire, that you maybe need to ride that bike a little more point and squirt. where Vinales doesn't seem to want to do that. And Vinales is too moody. Like, if, like, this is like a death blow to him in his championship, I think. Just because, well, it may not be a death blow, but what it is, it's psychological advantage Quartararo, because as soon as any, you know, Vinales starts out, if everything's going his way, he's happy-go-lucky. Yeah, this is awesome. We're cool. Yeah. Awesome. We're having a great weekend. The first sign of any small problem, he just turns into Debbie Downer and goes, oh, woe is me. The sky's falling. I don't think we're ever going to be able to finish this. I just know what we're going to do with the bike. It's just great. Dude, you gotta man up. Part of this is you. You have to ride with what's there and what you're given. And Quartararo, I think, is way better at doing that than Vinales is.
Well, and the thing is, Vinales is out of excuses. First, it was, this year's bike is actually worse than last year's bike. That's why it's good. It's all the same equipment. In fact, you're on the factory bike, and he's on the factory bike, but you're in the factory team, and you're getting trounced. And if Petronas keeps going out there and beating the factory team, Quartararo's got to be looking like, I don't really know if I want to go to the factory team, but or at least take some of his guys with him. But I do wonder if Lynn Jarvis's job is on the line here a little bit, because if his factory guys are getting beat by the Petronas guys and they can see the potential was in the bike all along, that's not going to be a good look. That means the wrong people are in the wrong positions there in the factory team. But that's a topic for another day, because we really need to get this show wrapped up.
So yeah,
this brings us into a Yamaha 1-2-3. That is the first time that's happened since 2014. So that brings us to Quartararo with the win. A very nice win. That's back-to-back for him. Maverick Vinales in second. Valentino Rossi in third. Taka Nakagami had a nice, strong fourth place. He was running down Rossi at the end, but I think he ran out of tire. Joan Mir had a nice, quiet fifth-place ride. Andrea Dovizioso, thankfully, finished in just below the top five in sixth place with a little bit of luck, but he's still, I think, recovering from injury. Paul Espargaró in seventh. Alex Marquez had a nice ride to eighth. Yes, a lot of guys fell off, but he did not. So that's why he gets an eighth place right there. He did beat Johann Zarco at a ninth. Johann's probably going to be out the back like this for the rest of the year. Alex Rins in 10th. Not a bad recovery ride for that man right there with his bum shoulder. Tito Rabat 11th. Bradley Smith in 12th. And Kyle Crutchlow riding out the field in 13th, getting some points. That's why he went back out there. So that brings us to the championship. Fabio Quartararo, he's gone back-to-back. So that's a solid 50 points. Maverick Vinales sitting right there in 40th. And a big jump down to Dovizioso. Dovizioso is already 34 points behind in the championship. Or should be 24 points behind in the championship. Not where you want to be. Almost a full race after two races. In third, that's going to be tough to gain, especially with the way Quartararo is riding. Taka Nakagami in fourth. Paul Espargaró in fifth. Rossi in sixth. Now, like we said last week, we're looking at Quartararo as being a definite front runner for the championship. And at this point, it's probably either him or Vinales, and I think advantage Quartararo for sure. Bernal is going to be interesting. I really think with Quartararo getting these wins under his belt, the confidence of getting the win and the nerves of getting that first one out of the way, he's only going to get faster this year, and we're really going to get to see what this kid has to offer.
I agree with you, but we spent two weekends at a track that flatters a Yamaha. We're going to tracks now, and predominantly the rest of the tracks are not Yamaha-esque tracks. There's no Sachsenring, there's no Assen, we're going to Brno, big long straights, horsepower hill. We're going to Red Bull Ring twice in Austria. Again, big, fast, long straights where you got to believe that the Ducatis and the Hondas are going to be out front. Marquez will be back for Brno. Will he be strong enough to ride at the front at a pace that's possible for him to win? Could be. Is he 50 points behind? Yes. Is that insurmountable? Not because he's him, but because the chaos that will ensue as this happens. You got to think Marquez is going to win, like you said, probably half of them that's there. But again, it's Quartararo has got to be able to manage the situation that he's in. He needs to understand that he may not win in Brno. It could be Miller. It could be Bagnaia, just because the Ducatis have horsepower. But if he's on the podium, that's where he needs to be. He needs to be as close to the front all the time and not be in the gravel trap. That will win you races. It will win you championships. This kind of maybe seems like a little bit like 2000 when Kenny Roberts Jr. won. He got out of the gate real early, put races, got wins, put the points in the bank, and as the season wore on, Rossi got closer to him, but it wasn't enough for him to actually overtake him in the championship. We might see something like this where just consistency is going to be the key factor to winning this one, as opposed to just winning races and races and races and races.
Yeah, we'll see. So we're going to go ahead and wrap this up here. So remember, folks, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/motopod. That's our Motopod fan page. We're also on Twitter at @moto_pod. You can find me at SkylarV28 on both Twitter and Instagram. Jim, where can people find you?
I'm MotoRGV on Instagram and Twitter.
Perfect. All right, Jim. Well, man, back-to-back races. We get a breather for a week, and then we're right back at it. So, racing, so much racing has been good. The season already has plenty of chaos for you to enjoy, and there's going to be so much more coming, and I can't wait to get back to it.